I really want to emphasize the remainder of our time this week is the powerful illustrations that fill Jesus' teaching that emphasize that fact. And we don't have to go very far in the Gospels, even the Gospel of Matthew, to begin noticing some of those. In Matthew 4, verse 19, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men," Jesus said to those he was calling. And in Matthew 5, verse 14, as we've just sung, "You are the light of the world." Or as we'll particularly be noticing tonight in Matthew 5, 13, "You are the salt of the earth." It's that last one I really want us to focus on tonight, but the lessons tonight, tomorrow night, and Wednesday night all grow out of my having recently become very intrigued with Jesus' various references to salt in the Gospels. Each of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, quote Jesus mentioning salt as an illustration in his teaching. In Luke, for instance, in Luke 14, verses 34 and 35, Jesus said, "Salt is good, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is of no use either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown away. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." That's Luke's record of Jesus talking about salt. Mark's is different. In Mark 9, verses 49 and 50, Mark records Jesus saying, "Everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its saltiness, how will you make it salty again? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace one with another." Of course, the one we're studying tonight is the one that's most familiar to us, and that's the one in Matthew 5, verse 13. Jesus said again, "You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot." Now, though these passages overlap in thought to some extent, each of them is actually quite unique. Each is unique in how Jesus developed the salt illustration on that occasion. In Matthew 5, Jesus is saying, "You are to be salt." In Mark, he's saying, "You will be salted." And as we'll notice Wednesday night, in Luke, he's saying, "You must remain salty." Each development of that salt illustration is a little different. And not only that, in each passage, Jesus' use of salt in an illustration is in a context that's rather different than in the other Gospels. And so I hope that you'll not think that tonight you've heard it all and I'm going to repeat it the next two nights, because I assure you the next two nights' lessons will be quite different than tonight. And actually, they have principles that are crucial to our living tonight's lesson. If we are going to truly be the salt of the earth, we must be willing to be salted, and we must endeavor to remain salty. It seems that universally, when these salt passages are discussed, that inquiring minds want to know, what did salt represent to the people then? How was salt used in the first century? And I have heard so many suggestions and read so many ideas about proposed properties and uses of salt in ancient times. Probably Leon could tell us a lot more about that than anyone I've ever met. But I chose not to talk to him about it before this lesson. I'm sure before I go to bed that anything I've missed, he'll straighten out. One idea I've heard is that salt was valuable. We've got this English idiom, worth his salt. And we're reminded that that idiom dates all the way back to Roman times, when many times people, especially soldiers, as I've read, were paid in salt. I've even read that our word salary comes from a word for salt that they used a lot back then. And so the idea is suggested that what Jesus is saying is that we need to be valuable to the world. I've heard some other ideas that are, I think, a little more far-fetched. I heard one person say that, oh, it's clear, Jesus is thinking about the fact that salt promotes thirst. And when he uses salt as an illustration, he's saying that we need to live in a way that we arouse people's thirst for God. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I'm not sure if that's what Jesus was thinking about, but that's what I've heard. And then even more far-fetched, I heard someone say that, salt was an irritant. It still is an irritant. And that what Jesus was teaching them is that in our talking to others, that we need to be willing to rub people the wrong way. Well, I guess we do need to be willing to rub people the wrong way sometimes. But again, I question if that's really what Jesus had in mind. The real question, I think, is instead of pulling ideas out of the air, what guidance does the Bible give us on this question? And first of all, in Jesus speaking in the Gospels, did Jesus suggest any specific uses of salt that he had in mind? And actually, I don't see any of this in Jesus' teaching, but actually Jesus' teaching was pretty general. In Mark 9, verse 50, the King James Version renders the Greek a little more literally than some of our other versions, like the ESV that I'm using a lot tonight. He said, if the salt loses its saltness, if it quits doing what salt does, that's pretty general, isn't it? And maybe Jesus didn't want to us to limit our thinking to just one particular use of salt or another. The closest Jesus gets in his teaching to specifically mentioning something about salt is salt's taste. And indeed, that is the most common use of salt throughout time is seasoning food. In Matthew, the 5th chapter, the 13th verse, if salt has lost its taste, if it's become tasteless, if it loses its flavor, beyond those suggestions in Jesus' teaching, it seems to me that if Jesus wanted people to think of anything specific about salt, it would have been his expecting that when his Jewish audience heard him mention salt, that he could expect them to be thinking about the positive uses of salt mentioned again and again in the Old Testament. And maybe that's a good place for us to look for some ideas about what we ought to be thinking about when we read Jesus' salt illustrations. In the Old Testament, we find the idea of seasoning, that salt seasons. In Job, the 6th chapter, in the 6th verse, can flavorless food be eaten without salt? Is there any flavor in the unsalted white of an egg? Everyone that's been on a cholesterol diet says none at all. The idea of seasoning goes beyond common meals, though, to even some of the sacrifices, the offerings to God. Think about the grain offerings that were salted and the priests eating many sacrifices, and those sacrifices were to be accompanied with salt. In Leviticus, the second chapter, the 13th verse, Moses wrote, "You shall season all your grain offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you are to offer salt." Salt seasoned. Even the food that the priests ate to suggest the fellowship with God that the people had in that food offering, they were to salt it. Now, other ideas grow out of the phrase, the salt of the covenant, or the similar phrase, covenant of salt, that's mentioned here in Leviticus 2:13, and we'll think about that in just a moment in looking at a passage that gives more information about that. But we have that idea of seasoning in the Old Testament, and we have the idea of purification in passages that talk about salt. The idea of purity is there. For instance, in the instructions regarding the incense that the priests were to make and were to burn, particularly at the hour of prayer and other times, turn to Exodus 30. In Exodus 30, verses 35 through 37, notice what we read there. Exodus 30, 35 through 37. There's some advantages to having scripture on the screen, but I think there's advantages to our opening our Bibles and having a sense of context, even if we don't discuss it a lot. But in Exodus 30, verse 35, Moses said, "And make an incense blended as by the perfumer, seasoned with salt, pure and holy. You shall beat some of it very small and put part of it before the testimony in the tent of meeting where I shall meet you. It shall be most holy for you. And the incense that you shall make according to its composition, you shall not make for yourselves. It shall be for you holy to the Lord." There's that idea of holiness and purification with salt. And so notice in that passage in verse 35, seasoned with salt, pure and holy. Verse 36, it is to be most holy for you. Verse 37, it shall be for you holy to the Lord. We've got that idea of seasoning that would have been in first century Jews' minds regarding salt, and this idea of purity of purity, and then thirdly, preservation. Salt preserves. That's also talked about in the Old Testament in a number of ways. In Numbers 18, verses 8 through 20, Moses spoke to the priests about the various sacrifices and other offerings that they could share in with the Lord. Of course, some of the sacrifices, it was all burned. But some of it, the priests were allowed to take of and eat. And in Numbers 18, verse 19, Moses talked about that, describing a covenant of salt. Notice how he modifies it. In Numbers 18, verse 19. "All the holy contributions that the people of Israel present to the Lord, I give to you, you priests, and to your sons and daughters with you as a perpetual due." Some of your versions say, "as an ordinance forever." It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord for you and for your offspring with you. Notice those words, perpetual and forever, connected with this idea of salt. Salt preserves, it perpetuates. Similarly, in 2 Chronicles, the 13th verse, or 13th chapter, the 5th verse, King Abijah of Judah is shouting to King Jeroboam II of Israel, And the king of Judah says to the king of Israel, ought you not to know that the Lord God of Israel gave the kingship over Israel forever to David and his sons by a covenant of salt? Once again, that idea of something not just in the literal physical realm, but in the spiritual conceptual realm, this idea of salt perpetuating, preserving something is there. Here, it's the kingship over Israel being preserved for the family of David, which of course is ultimately fulfilled by Jesus. Acts 2, verses 29 through 32, that Jesus, the son of David, would be raised from the dead, exalted to the Father's right hand to sit on David's throne, that is ruling over the people of God. The IVP Bible background commentary says about salt, salt was used widely as symbolic of preservation. When treaties or alliances were made, salt was employed to symbolize that the terms would be preserved for a long time. Babylonian, Persian, Arabic, and Greek contexts all testify to this symbolic usage. In the Bible, likewise, the covenants between the Lord and Israel are often identified as a covenant of salt, a long preserved covenant. And so we see salt seasons, salt purifies, salt preserves. Those are thoughts that are repeated again and again in a positive way regarding salt in the Old Testament, would likely have been known, well known, by the Jews to whom Jesus was speaking the Sermon on the Mount. And so very likely they would be thinking of these things. And so that background would be good for you and me to keep in mind the next three nights as we study about Jesus' use of salt in Matthew 5, Mark 9, and Luke 14. Look at Matthew 5, verses 13 through 16 with me. Turn there. Matthew 5, 13 through 16. In this context, Jesus says, you are salt. Let those words sink in. You, if you're a disciple of the Lord, you are salt. Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all that are in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. You are salt. And in that connection, notice two amazing prepositional phrases that Jesus uses. He says, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Think about that. Not just salt and light of your little village. Not just salt and light of the province you live in. Not even just salt and light of Palestine. He says to these disciples, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. And there are two principles wrapped up in that dual illustration of salt and light that we really need to pack away in our thoughts and to take home and meditate on. And that is the reference to light in connection with salt helps us understand that what Jesus is talking about in Matthew 5, 13 through 16 is our having spiritual influence. Jesus is referring to influence. Ye, the King James Version stresses the plural you in the Greek. Ye are the salt of the earth. Ye are the light of the world. Individually, brothers and sisters, cooperatively, as we individually work with other individuals, as well as congregationally, Jesus says, you are to be the salt, not just of Coleman or Hansville or Coleman County or Alabama or even the United States. You are to be the salt of the earth, the light of the world. And we don't have a lot of time for me to get into that, but I'd love to take you through the book of Philippians and notice how Paul develops that idea in the book of Philippians of fellowship in the gospel. Every chapter has one or more ways that Paul discusses with the Philippians that they had fellowship with him and God in the gospel, in the message going to the world. That's what the Lord wants of us. He wants us to influence the world. Now, the other principle that is there is that salt and light only affect what they contact. Have you thought about that? They only affect what they contact. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. People need to be able to see the difference that Christ is making in our lives. They need the contact of hearing us speak of him and the wonderful acts of mercy that he has had toward us. We need to realize that salt and light only work if they have contact. Look at Matthew 5 again. Matthew 5:13. You are the salt of the earth. Let's see if I have that on here. Yes. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? That makes us think that second it is salt, doesn't it? But actually, the pronoun, the it, is not in the Greek. And so it makes us think about it. Maybe Jesus is talking about how shall the salt be seasoned. But I wonder if it might be practically beneficial for us if we thought of that second it as the earth. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall the earth be seasoned? I'm not making an argument for that, but I do think there's some practical benefit in us thinking about it that way. If we cease to be salty, or if we simply keep the salt in the cabinet, or as I heard Joe preach years ago, we keep the salt in the salt shaker, how will the earth, that is the people of this globe, be spiritually seasoned, purified, preserved? Contact is essential. We've all heard, though, lessons about how important it is for us to be tactful in sharing the gospel. That we don't want to unnecessarily rub people the wrong way. I agree with that. But I want to tell you, people are more likely to be saved by a presentation of the gospel that lacks tact than to be saved as a result of someone being afraid to share the gospel because they're afraid they might not be tactful. Or to put it more briefly, in evangelism, the most important tact is contact. We've got to share the gospel. And we won't be perfect at it. We'll make mistakes. We will come away sometimes feeling like we've unnecessarily turned someone off. We learn from that. We learn by doing in the service of the Lord. And it is so often the case that it is God's purpose in having us teach the person in front of us to train us for teaching the person that we're going to meet in the future that can actually be converted. We must recognize God's desire that we have influence and realize that influence can only be savingly effective if we have contact. Jesus says, "You are salt." It's startling. He doesn't say you should be, though of course he means that. He doesn't say you ought to be or I hope you'll become, but he startles us. You are salt. As salt must contact food to season it, we Christians must contact the world to influence it as God desires. This is our purpose. Our purpose. Jesus continues in Matthew 5, verse 13, "But if salt has lost its taste, it is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot." In the parts of Asia that I've visited, several countries, when the people clean their houses, they don't have a dustpan usually that, you know, they sweep up the floor and then they put it in the dustpan and they go over and drop it in the trash like we do at my house. They open the front door and they sweep it all out the front door into the street or the roadway. And the traffic just runs over it. And if there's anything that would be harmful or many times I think poisonous that they want to get rid of, well, you put it on the street. If it would kill grass, it's good for it to be on the road so no vegetation grows there. In this case, if salt became contaminated in some way, you can't put it on the manure pile that they used as fertilizer on the fields or the fields wouldn't grow. You can't take the salt and just scatter it on the field. The field won't grow. It's fit for nothing but to be put on the roadway where it'll be trampled underfoot. What's Jesus saying to us? He's saying that our being the salt of the earth is our purpose, and if we are not living as the salt of the earth, then we are useless. We're useless. But he's actually saying more than that. Because what he says about the salt, it being good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled on by the foot of men, he's saying that that salt is worse than useless. It's harmful. It would hurt the fields. Brethren, our being the salt of the earth, the light of the world, is serious business. It's our purpose. But I want you to think about that too. I don't want to just convict you. I want to encourage you. It is our purpose. But as it is our purpose, it is what we were created to do. My father passed a couple of years ago and my mother sold the farm I grew up on. She sold it last fall and moved to town. They had decided to sell the farm before my dad died, and I made multiple trips to Mississippi. My dad couldn't do much himself, but he could guide me in cleaning out the sheds and could tell me what to keep and what to discard. And I'd find something that a great-grandfather had used on farm. And I, "What's this, Daddy?" And he said, "Will you tell me what you think it is? What would that be used for?" And I would suggest something, and he'd kind of chuckle. "I guess you could use it for that, but it would work a lot better for what it was designed for, and he would tell me what its purpose actually was. Sometimes we maybe haven't known what we were created for. And we tried to find our purpose in some other way, and sometimes it kind of seemed to work. But when you use a tool specifically as it was designed to be used for the purpose that it was designed for, that's when it's a pleasure to use the tool. And when we learn our purpose and we believe that God has created us to influence others for Him, it may take us a little while to get really comfortable with that idea. But I'm telling you that when we do, we find our fulfillment. When we do, we feel so, so blessed. We're not just hitting and missing anymore. We're doing what we were made to do. We become vessels of honor, useful for the Master. And isn't that what we want? You are the salt of the earth. Did Jesus die that we alone might be saved? Of course not. He died for all. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 15. He died for all that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for Him who for their sakes died and was raised. He did not die for us alone. He died for all the billions of people around us in this world who don't know Him yet. Did you learn the gospel so that you alone could be saved? When God arranged for you to learn from your parents or your next door neighbor or a buddy at school or someone you worked with or someone who knocked on your door, when God arranged for you to meet someone who knew Jesus and knew the gospel, like He arranged for the Ethiopian in Acts 8 to meet Philip, or Cornelius in Acts 10 to meet Peter, when God arranged for you to learn the gospel, was it His plan that you would be learning it so that you alone could be saved as a result? I think we know. No, He wants us to be saved so that then others can be saved as we share the knowledge of Jesus with them. Do you ever see the song in the supplement of Apples in the Seed? Have you sung that? If it doesn't look like anyone has a look of, we'll have to do that this week. Not the easiest song, but not the most difficult either, but wonderful, wonderful symbolism. That when you look at an apple, you can tell how many seeds are in the apple. But when you look at a seed, can you tell how many apples are in the seed? That if you planted that seed, how many apples would eventually be produced? I think it's a wonderful symbolism. And when we... When you share the gospel with the next person you have an opportunity to share the gospel with, whether it's the first or the 5,000th person you've shared the gospel with, when you share the gospel with the next person you'll share the gospel with, how many souls will be in heaven potentially because of that action? Ananias in Acts 9. Oh Lord, You want me to teach Saul of Tarsus? Don't You know he's been persecuting Christians? But the Lord convinces Ananias to go and teach Saul. And Saul, of course, becomes the Apostle Paul. who could say, I've labored more abundantly than them all, than any of the other apostles, yet not I, but the grace of God that is in me. In 1993, I went to Vietnam the first time, and then my wife went with me later that year. My family moved to Vietnam in January of 1994. And all the work was in Ho Chi Minh City, or as many of us know it, Saigon. From 1993 to 2000. But in 2000, Sandy Rogers, a Vietnamese American sister in Northwest Arkansas, who had been calling me for a few years to talk with me about her family that she had not seen in decades since she married an American serviceman during the war and came to the States. But finally, in early 2000, late 1999, she had an opportunity to go to Vietnam. And so she calls me in February of 2000, and she says, Alan, I went to Vietnam, and I did what you told me to. Can you go baptize my family? And I said, what did I tell you to do? And she said, well, when I told you that I'd never taught anyone, you told me that even if I could not teach my family personally, that if I would show them my joy and hope in Jesus Christ, that they would want to know of Jesus and that I would be able to go and teach them. She said, I did that. I showed them my joy and hope in Jesus, and they want to be baptized. When can you go do that? I said, they probably need to be taught, Sandy. Okay, go teach them. When can you go teach them? And in March of 2000, a young Vietnamese college student who had been converted went with me. We rode the train all night from Saigon up to Cam Ranh, where her oldest brother and his family lived. And we studied with them. And her brother, Duc, and her sister-in-law, Nhoc, were baptized. And later that year, Joe Shane taught Duc's younger brother, Phung. How many apples are in the seed? We had no idea. It was a big family. All the siblings have been converted, all their mates, their children. They've taught folks that Vietnamese typically won't associate with, minority tribal peoples. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people have been taught. Many, many, many have been converted. Multiple churches started because Nhi and I were willing to make an overnight train ride and teach in a difficult area where the roads were almost impassable and there was no running water. We find our purpose. We find fulfillment on a level that we've never known before. Jesus didn't want you to hear of him just so you could be saved. He wanted you to hear of him so that still others could be saved through you. Our purpose in Christ is to be the salt of the earth. Dare we deny or merely neglect our very purpose? God help us say no. God help us say no. That which will please the Lord is what we were created and saved to do. Our fulfillment now is doing that. Our salvation in eternity is made all the more likely because of our doing that and what it does for our own faith and reliance upon the Lord. Submitting to the one who died for us, serving the one who arose for us, sharing the one whose instructions come with enabling promises. That's what we're doing when we live out our purpose as the salt of the earth. Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth." He promised, "Follow me and I will make you fishers of men." Notice, follow me is a command, but that's a command any of us can do. We can follow. But the command is tied to a promise. Notice the latter part of the verse is a promise. Follow me, do what you can do, and I'll do what you can't. I will make you, that's that transforming grace, isn't it? I will make you fishers of men, that you might be, by grace, utilized in my service to help other people be saved too. Following Jesus begins with learning of him, putting our trust in him, repenting of our sins, deciding we don't want to sin anymore, and submitting to him in that simple act of baptism, immersion in water, as Romans 6 verse 3 says, joining Jesus in his death that we might be raised with him to newness of life. If we have someone here tonight who has not done those things, trusting in the Lord's promise to save you by his grace, do it tonight. And then let's all continue to follow. Let's continue to think about the purpose for which the Lord has made us. The purpose of contacting others with the knowledge of Jesus, that they might be influenced to turn to him and be saved too. If you need to begin following him tonight by being baptized, or if you need to resume following him as a child of God, you can take care of that personally, or maybe you need to make confession or need prayer, whatever, we ask that you come forward, sit up here on this front row.